Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour Podcast. It's almost championship week, Rosie, and then there were two, the Denver Outlaws, the Philadelphia Water Dogs, the title game collision course complete. Alongside Chris Rosenthal, I'm Kevin Brown for Inside Lacrosse, and Rosie, we are coming off some great semifinal action in Salt Lake City. We are bound to preview much of the storylines coming our way for the 2026 PLL Championship in Harrison, New Jersey, Sports Illustrated Stadium. Get your tickets September 20th, going to be on ABC, I believe. Can't miss action. We'll have a bunch of coverage for championship weekend. Rosie, how we doing? How we feeling? How pumped are we?
Pretty fired up. We were just talking about how this season is coming to an end. Rounding that corner, going to sprint through the finish line here. Great matchup. End up in the championship weekend. Can't wait to get out there and see it.
Yeah. About 5 months that this season has gone for, from the first training camps back in April to now the postseason wrapping up in September. You know, it's all about who can peak in September in this league. And, you know, the Denver Outlaws are getting healthy. The Philadelphia Water Dogs have been showing people that they got that talent, and then they got that star power, and they got too many options offensively, basically, and defensively. We'll get into it, but just an absolute masterclass from both these defenses, really, to advance past the semifinal round in Salt Lake City at Science-Baked Stadium, where your boy got to experience the awesome atmosphere, the incredible backdrop of the mountains in the background, and the absolute gut punch of Tom Shriver being rolled out all in one. So, surreal experience to fly out to Utah, Rosie. It was a really cool trip for myself. Got to experience such a cool atmosphere. The environment was really fun. A lot of kids. A lot of, like you mentioned on the last podcast, just fans who are really good at fanning out. Yeah, you know, their fandom for the Archers is really sincere, organic. I think it's funny watching the Seattle Seahawks kind of NFL opener as well. Like, I don't think Salt Lake City is quite considered Pacific Northwest, but to me, they're kind of in that same sort of fan vibe, or like, you know, they got a little bit of innocence about them. They just root really hard for their team. They boo Brendan O'Neill, and they don't go over the top with it. But the fact of the matter was, Tom Shriver, that much was made of his return 409 days removed from last playing in Salt Lake City, where he tore his meniscus, has had a tough road to recovery, and, you know, spoke to USA Lacrosse magazine, and Hunton Jackson did a great article on him, and where he admitted he was considering retirement, you know, and then to read that, to go into this one so excited for him, like, yeah, it's our job as media to build this up and like get excited about his return, because how could you not? He's a three-time MVP, one of the best players to ever play the game, one of the best midfielders for sure. And I just felt bad, like everyone feels bad for him as a person just because of how great of a guy he is and for the sport. But you knew that was just such a gut, like there's got to be some mental involved with not being quite ready to play. I didn't quite see what happened in warmups where he tweaked it, but post game comments, Coach Chris Bates saying, you know, an hour before the game he's ready to go, 5 minutes before the game not so much. So Rosie, that kind of set the tone for this first semifinal, in which Denver raced out to a 9-1 first half lead and ended up winning 11-5 in a lackluster second half. But the first half was deflating for the Archers, and Denver's Twerton firepower just came to play. So, Rosie, first, just on Shriver, what was your immediate reactions, and how did you experience the first semifinal in full?
Yeah, so the thing about Tom Shriver, that situation, I think, is, you know, even if you're not a Shriver fan, or you were never an Archers fan or a Machine fan or anything like that, it's a situation that I think everyone can at least find some sort of way to relate to it, right? Because, you know, we've seen him do hundreds upon hundreds of things on the cross fields that most of us on our greatest days of players could have never even imagined we would do. But probably everybody can relate to working really hard for something and ultimately it not going your way, right? Or thinking you're going to have a good day and then something, you know, throws a wrench in it and ruins that, right? So I think from almost sort of the universal standpoint, that's what really stuck out to me when, you know, the news comes across just a few minutes before the game that, you know, after this buildup, after this excitement that, you know, it kind of leaks with the photos, it's like, oh, Tom's practicing again. You know, and then you start kind of doing the math and you're like, they've got this extra time. Maybe he'll be ready. And then you finally hear that he is going to be back. And then that becomes the story. You know, he's actually returning. Can't wait to see him again. And then to get that close, you know, it's just such a letdown, just such a kick in the chest. And I'm sure he must feel terrible about it. You know, it sounds like you said, a tweak. So, right, it wasn't necessarily something that everyone can tell right away that, like, oh, you know, like if you tear your Achilles or something like that, you're going to drop to the ground and everybody knows that's a wrap for you. But it seems like it was something where it was like, you know, I think Coach Bates mentioned maybe some swelling. It wasn't quite reacting in a positive manner. And that sort of thing is almost a situation where you're kind of faced in a position where you have to sort of make that call more than an obvious thing that takes you out. So I have to imagine, you know, being real to himself, being understanding of what he was capable of at the time, was really difficult to say, you know, I've been working this hard, but I'm not quite ready yet. So, you know, just feel awful for him. It was very tough to see that sort of thing. And, you know, hopefully it was ultimately the smart move. And, you know, instead of rushing back, which might have been the case in 400 days, but still it could be too early. So hopefully this sets him on a better course that he would have, you know, maybe had to deal with some trouble if he did try to muscle his way through, obviously something that wasn't quite ready to happen for him. Now, as for the game itself, I think the opening to it, Brendan O'Neill going straight after the Archers on that, I think kind of set the tone for the whole game, right? Like, the Outlaws go into Utah, and basically they just kind of sent the message, they're not scared, they're going to bring the fight to them, and they're going to be physical when they need to be physical, and, you know, they're just going to basically just pop them in the mouth right away, you know, sort of literal and figurative sort of way, but I think that's what they needed to do, and I think they all fed on that, and, you know, I think that was part of the recipe that got it done this time for them.
It really was. What a tone setter that O'Neill goal was. And not just him. Jared Bernhardt comes soaring through the middle of the field, makes it 2-0. Pat Kavanaugh, just quickly the third goal for Denver, getting around that screen and the fake and finish with the jumping across the crease. So when you get your big three setting the tone like that, that's a really good sign for Denver, and it set up just a spectacular stretch in the early second where, you know, Pat Kavanaugh caps it off with that two-pointer following Chris's range expansion this season, and that makes it like, oh, maybe that's an early dagger. I'd still give, like, Utah a chance. But then all of a sudden, Bernhardt gets topside off Dobson's head and in. That's a bit more of a backbreaker. Then they go off sides, and then you got Tarasenko storming down the field, and an easy dunk for O'Neill for the hat trick, 9-1, beat the buzzer, 1 second left. Oh my goodness, like, shouldn't even have had to play the second half at that point, but, you know, great fight from the two-time champs and the archers to at least make it somewhat interesting in the third. Dauber came out on fire, finished with 17 saves, 65 or 66% in net, and, you know, he was letting a few go that he probably would want back, including that two-pointer in the first half, and then the Jake Pisano two-pointer really sealed it. So 11-5 win for Denver by this time of the week. Of course, you know all that happened, and now we got some more takeaways to go through here, Rosie, but just to quickly recap the second semifinal and set the stage for everyone, because, you know, it was maybe a month and a half ago when I canceled the title game Collision Course. And I don't think I ever told you, Rosie, but there was a part of me deep down inside that knew, maybe not knew, but it was kind of holding out hope. I don't know if hope is the right word, trying to be objective journalist here, but you want to see the best players playing in the last game. And these two teams had the best two rosters coming into the season when it came to star power and overall ability from defense to offense, and, well, especially offense to defense. And, you know, the Denver injuries were just absolutely, like, causing them issues all year. 6-6 finish, 500, okay, never quite themselves. You're thinking, all right, maybe they just can't put it together this year, but, like, it's kind of the... And we'll get to this later when we get to some off-season outlooks with Atlas. Like, if you're having an off-season, you kind of want to have, like, a really bad season to get the top pick. And
sure.
We'll see how it works out for Atlas in a depleted class with 5-5 and everything and who's actually going to come out. But I'm sure someone will, and you at least got Bobby Van Buren you can pick. So, tangent aside, finished the tangent point that Philadelphia, of course, had a really bad season in Bill Tierney's first year and got CJ cursed out of it. So CJ curse puts this game on ice, and boy, oh boy, Owen Grant gets caught going over the head check. You know, he's like, I got help with CJ circling the cage. Surely he won't get past like two more guys. A little toe drag, twister into the coffee can. Sure thing he can. 3-2 for him. 2-2 for Sowers. The co-MVP race continues, but of course the ballots may have already been in at that point. And based on the regular season, I do believe definitely not on any semifinal performances. Rosie, 13-10 finish from this one for the Water Dogs. The Cannons showed a lot of fight to come back when they were down 12-6, getting doubled up early in the fourth to come back, make it a one possession game, 12-10 at one point. So what was your overall impression of this game before we get to around some takeaways?
Well, I think what goes, you know, when you think about this game, the first sort of thing is clearly the consistency of Michael Sowers has not wavered in the longest time. He's been good for generally four or five points around that each and every time he gets out on the field. He had a one game forever ago where he was held to 2 points, and that was the second game of the season. It was against these Cannons, so, you know, maybe that kind of could have been something to hang their hats on moving forward there, but never even sniffed two after the second game of the season. Three was his worst. So if we are talking MVP there for a second, I think something he has definitely going for him is the constant consistency. But real big takeaway from this game, and we'll say more of a reminder because we've seen it a few times in the past here with this Water Dogs team, is if it's not them, it's gonna be somebody else. And each and every time, if you could think you have a pretty good day, even if four is a lot to hold somebody to, but they're just gonna get something from a Josh Yago, right? Or something from a Kyle Lewis, or maybe a hat trick from him. And they're just so good as a collective offense from finding either one weakness or either someone on their side who's feeling their shot, especially on that day, or loving their matchup and cashing in on it. That's what I think has made.
It really is pick your poison. It's unfair to watch this offense click. And, having followed all these rookies in college, I've been saying it all year. Like, they do look like a super team. You bring in Gavin Adler to really tie it all together in that super team feel. It's compared it to Durant joining the Warriors at one point this season when Adler joined. But they drafted so well, and I don't think anyone was too worried. Maybe Bill Tierney was the only one that the rookies would play super young and make a lot of mistakes. But they've got playoff experience at the collegiate level. Josh Yago, obviously, with Notre Dame making it to the championship game this weekend, this past spring, rather. Matt Collison making some quarterfinal runs with Johns Hopkins, Silas Richmond winning conference titles with Albany, and Kyle Lewis just calling game for Delphi his junior year, and of course heartbreak as a senior. He is amazing. He is so good. First career hat trick. Which was hard to believe for a second for me because he has been so dynamic this season that I'm like, really? But when you look at all the box scores, it is fascinating that he wasn't getting a lot of touches. He was kind of like that fourth guy out of the box, I feel like, for a lot of those games early on coming out. So for him to, all right, they're starting to play CJ and Mike a little better, my time to shine. And boy, oh boy, like they scored, I think, 8 of their combined 9 points in the first half. Kyle Lewis, I think, had 2 of his 3 goals in the second, if I'm remembering correctly, because they were all on the run. The lefty take was especially indicative of his athleticism at an interception on the other end to set it up kind of late in the third quarter, I believe. Just so athletic. And when you got Josh Yago, who can rip it from long distance, he's kind of in that Sean Byrne camp who expressed to us post game after the regular season finale in Philly, where he's like, yeah, this is super gratifying for me. I never was guaranteed another lacrosse game in my life and got this opportunity. Army loses to Penn State in the NCAA tournament. He's like, not sure what he's going to do from here. Goes the athletic intern route. Josh Yago's doing the Space Force route. So potentially two guys who could be around just for one more game for Philadelphia. And when you look at next season, they're gonna have to reload in those two positions potentially. But the pick your poison aspect of this offense was just too much to handle for a Boston defense that matched up pretty well, I thought. Owen Grant against CJ, I really like that matchup. Of course, 5 points in the winner was, CJ's year, of course, and Mike. Just a balanced, didn't really force it too much issue. CJ had that first goal similar to Brennan, which he kind of sets the tone with about 34 seconds in coming around. Mike answers. I think Coulter Maxey had Boston's first, and of course, Sauer's coming around with his left too. So they were playing all the hits, Rosie. All the hits were being played with Philly Stroman and not quite a free. I don't know if they're a Freebird team. You know, Princeton really adopted that, and the "I Wanna Be Your Girl" song over the spring. So we'll have to find out what exactly is the Water Dog song, but if you have anything that comes to mind, you're more of the music guy in this podcast,
Well,
so
I'll
let
tell
me
you,
know.
let's put that on the list because we will be talking to a bunch of these water dogs very soon,
Oh
Chub
yeah.
Chub Weekend Media Day. So we'll put that on the list of stuff. What is the music that the team is rallying around? We do know Gavin Adler is just we know his psycho theme music that's constantly playing in his head. But now we got to get some answers for the rest of them. So we'll put that on the list. We will get some answers to that.
If you forgot, Gavin Adler did let us know during last year's Championship Media Day that he listens to Halloween, the theme song, to get in the zone for games. And he reiterated that on the Stick Talk appearance, which you should go listen to. We've said the last couple podcasts, but it is still worth the listen. Because he made news again this week. A legendary coach, Bill Tierney, saying post game, you know, he's talked about this dynamic relationship before, where he and Gavin Adler talk about the defensive matchups in the beginning of every week. He values his opinion that much. And for a guy who's considered like the founding father of modern defense to be deferring to Gavin Adler when it comes to matchups is saying something. When you have, like, not only did they play free agency right to acquire his services, but man, they are really valuing him in this title run to get back there, and he is delivering. He really takes it seriously. I know everyone does in this league, but the commitment level that Gavin Adler has to the game and his game prep is second to none. Because, you know, he is like, I didn't talk to him, so this is not so much speculation as more of just my read of how he saw the individual matchups. So he takes the Marcus Holman matchup, obviously. Bill Tierney says, "This is the first time we really disagreed." I assume that means Bill Tierney would have wanted Kenny Brower on Marcus Holman, and maybe you're putting Brennan Staub on the quicker Brian Kelly. You're keeping Gavin Adler on Colter McAsee, like we saw in the regular season matchups. And, you know, I remember Colter McAsee had that little step back two around a high screen against Adler earlier in the season when, you know, he's fighting the I think that might have been before the lower body injury. Anyway, the fact of the matter is, you see, Marcus Holman is the heart and soul of this offense, and Gavin Adler being the psycho defensive player of the year he is not going to let Marcus Holman take over this game at any point, no matter how he plays him. And he played him perfectly because he didn't score a goal against him. Marcus Holman's two goals came on a switch where he got to the middle and absolutely just picked that corner out. My goodness. Golly gosh, you can go check out the replay on IL's Instagram page because it's worth it. And then on a power play, on the point, so he finishes 2 for 12 shooting. And he's proven right. Gavin Adler, just absolute, another great game from him. Like, Colter McAsee to me is like, was more of the focal point. I mean, they're 1 and 2 in touches across the whole league, which was pretty fascinating coming in. I think that gap narrowed and narrowed as the back half of the season went along, because Colter McAsee was so much of the focal point all season long. But they share the ball so well and they're spinning it so quick that they are getting all these touches really quick. And, you know, they're not like Rob Pinnell or Mike Sowers where they're like initiating for Max. They're wing attackmen. So I thought it was really interesting. What did you make of that whole storyline of Gavin Adler calling the shots with a legend like Bill Tierney and, you know, them holding them to one of their kind of worst stretches at the wrong time for Cannon's offensive point of view?
Yeah. So huge thanks to Bill Tierney for sharing that story. Always cool to get that kind of transparency and insight. And, you know, it makes it more interesting to learn more about the game and understand where the mindset of these players and coaches, the direction it's really heading. So, yeah, very grateful that he was going to share that with us. I think a thing that you'll notice that's really key to success at the pro level for these, you know, college coaches transitioning is there's a degree of kind of unlearning. And then kind of relearning certain things, right? Because you kind of have to adjust to not having the same amount of practice time. And also that you're dealing with, you know, grown adult men. You know, you can't necessarily yell at everybody the same way as you could when they're, you know, 19 years old and scared of you a little bit and things like that, right? And Bill Tierney amasses this pretty much, you know, head and shoulders, just super dominant resume. But then he becomes a guy at a new job, right? And so he's got to figure out what is going to work and what isn't going to work. And some of the old stuff will play and some of it won't. And, you know, this one element where he says, you know, hey, maybe I don't know everything. Let me ask somebody else. You know, Gavin Adler, not only is he, you know, he's got this resume of his own being Defensive Player of the Year, but, you know, you're the guy who's actually going to go out there and make it happen. You got to go run around. You got to do the coverage. What do you think? And, you know, we'd seen the Brower-Holman matchup last season. We've seen success in that matchup. But, yeah, you know, it's important to understand when to defer. And I think some coaches have a tougher time as they join the pro ranks, learning when to take the reins off and, you know, not kind of go my way or the highway with it. But, you know, Bill Tierney, as the years progress, you know, gets a little more pro experience under his belt. I think this is another situation where he's doing a great job just kind of, and he'll be the first to admit it, which I think is super cool. He'll be the first to just say, yeah, I don't know everything. You know, like these guys have a much better idea what to do. You know, I'm along with this, on this ride with those guys. You know, I've got suggestions and I've got some ideas and I've got a vision, but you know, these guys are all really smart and have a really strong understanding of what it's going to take to get the job done. So yeah, I think big part of being a coach is, you know, kind of knowing when to get out of your own way. And it's definitely something that Bill Tierney has embraced and is doing successfully.
You know, when you have that much success, I think it's a little easier to later in your career have that humility to admit this too. So it's well said by you. And that matchup change led Brendan Staub to cover Coulter Maxey, and he did an awesome job. High on his ability to take Eric Spanos out of the 2025 championship game with Cornell when he moved down to close that year. And it was really similar. To me, it was just a shutdown performance for an elite player. Coulter Maxey couldn't get anything going. Kind of really took him out of the game completely there. So Brendan Staub deserves some flowers as well for his performance. All around, great performance. I think it was really indicative of Boston's season as a whole to even fight back that well in the fourth quarter to make it nervy for him. You know, you start your season 1-4 and, you know, call them overachievers, call them corny if you want. This is a team that really works so hard for each other, and it's the locker room what was really impressive. We got some cool insights post game that, you know, I always feel a little bad that, you know, they're talking to us for like over 20 minutes as a team who just got their heart ripped out, they're one game away from the title game and really reflecting on the season. And I don't have a ton of use for a lot of these quotes, but
Right.
it's cool to learn that like Connor Kurst is such a great presence in the locker room, and guys like just how valued he is, and kind of didn't realize, forgot about the fact that Jeff Traynor has been on Marcus Holman's teams and by his side, like this whole PLL ride here with the Archers and now over the Cannons. I talked about it last podcast that I didn't really get to confirm this with Marcus, but it had to mean a little more to play in Utah for a chance to play in the title game. Not only like, if it was Cannons Archers in the title game after this, that would have been the culmination of two teams who really flipped their season around from earlier, May and June. But also like Marcus Holman, Will Manny, they got those Utah connections with Coach Brian Holman, his dad. So really cool all around, and they just didn't have enough offensively, the rival Phillies defense. And when Sean Byrne is clicking a net, then they're really hard to beat. So just really impressive. I'm throwing a lot at you, kind of going all over the place with my takeaways, but they're not meant to be sequential. They're supposed to be takeaways here, off the cuff. What
Absolutely.
are you thinking on when it comes to just Cannons, big picture wise, how you looked at their season?
It's funny when you go to a lot of these, post game sort of things, or you see the interviews. I guess they're broadcast online now, so you can check them out. There's usually a pretty big fork in the road as far as like, especially semifinals, losing teams go, right? You'll have some, and you can just tell vibe wise, it's like these guys cannot wait to pack up and get out of the stadium and then and go home and not be around each other, and they're just kind of done, right? Run out of gas. And then you have some who have like a press conference like the Cannons had, right? Obviously sad that they lost, obviously disappointed that they don't get to go all the way and fight for that championship. But a team that really enjoyed just growing and experiencing just the evolution of their program this summer. I thought it was really interesting. Jeff Traynor, seasoned vet, many years now, said this was one of the, if not the most fun he's ever had, during a summer of pro lacrosse. And so I asked him why. I was like, well, what made this one so special? And part of it was the kind of influx of young talent that the Cannons have really, livened up the place. They have kind of, I'd say, the energy that you would expect them to have based on their game, right? Like if you said, what would it be like to bring in like a Mikey Weisar and a Jack Regnery and guys like that into your locker room, I feel like the way that they perform on the field is probably similar to how they are off of the field, right? They've got a sense of enthusiasm. They're having a great time. Super huge Lax Rats. That whole team, we heard that a dozen times this season. If Marcus Holman's describing them, if anybody up there who's on their broadcast after post game talking about someone, it's this guy's a giant Lax Rat, right? McMeekin, Hogg, you name it. These people just kind of all were super bought in, just loving the game of lacrosse. And it carried over to just hanging out, spending time with each other. And I think that just left them all in a really positive place moving forward. There's a lot of enthusiasm at the end of their season instead of kind of, disappointment or thinking, well, this was our shot. We gotta, scrub the whole thing, shake up the etch-a-sketch now and move forward with an entirely new direction. And so, yeah, as far as looking forward goes, a lot of contributors, you're looking at guys like Regnery, McMeekin, Mackesy only in his second year. A lot of rookies really came onto the program and, early guys who can push this thing in a new direction for a long time. So, maybe Brian Holman keeps an eye out for maybe a couple tweaks here and there to the roster. But I'd imagine he has to be feeling pretty good about things moving forward, especially if he has Matt Campbell back for a full, healthy season next year. Maybe gets Ryan Drenner back as well. A lot of, I guess he'll have some roster decisions to make, but he's got to feel like the whole team's pretty close to getting to that championship.
Yeah, no doubt. His initial answer of, when you add 18 or 8 22-year-olds in the locker room, then you're gonna have a little more fun. And the argument with those rookies of and second year guys, just the younger guys in general, of like, do they play young, make a lot of mistakes, or they just play fearless, and are they naive enough to know no different that, yeah, I'm this guy, like, of course, like, what do you mean? It's kind of the Jack Regnery sentiment the whole season. And it is a really interesting point you make with the vibes being so great and they're coming up short still. Like, it is a tough kind of, like, obviously it was a really bitter pill to swallow for them, and they were kind of really disappointed in not advancing. But from a look ahead point of view, like, when you appreciate your core so much in the culture that you just cultivated this season, how do you balance that with, like, you have to rival these, like, super teams these guys are, like, making? Like, Holman and Maxey proved to be a pretty good partnership this year. Brian Kelly, I documented his story, and how big a lax rat, and how he documented, mapped out the probabilities in his math class, that he was going to make it to the pros, and he ended up doing it. So, great season from him, defying all those odds. But when you have a group that, if you're going up against Sowers and Kirst and those rookies, and you consider that Teat and Schellenberger are going to be healthy and have probably a better surrounding cast next year, that's only in the East. We saw what the Outlaws could do in the postseason without ever being healthy in the regular season, and kind of a late 2010s NBA style, like, oh, the regular season doesn't matter, I'm just going to make it to the title game. It's going to be Warriors Cavs again. Like, the title game collision course, it was definitely odd, I'll tell you that much. It is so fascinating what these teams have to do this offseason that got eliminated in this semifinal round, because you hit on it there. You're hitting it with the Atlas came out when we're recording this here on Thursday, and when you're listening to this on Friday, you'll be able to read the Chaos offseason outlook as well. We'll be hitting the quarterfinal losers and the semifinal losers in the week leading up to the championship game as well. So, Rosie, you're a busy man talking to these GMs, but before we get into the nitty-gritty with those teams, just, like, do you have thoughts on that, of, like, just finding those little tweaks versus, and I do think Brian Holman showed the ability to be a little more cutthroat this year, like, starting JC Higginbotham and embracing a great faceoff guy like Andrew McMeekin. So, shifting Will Donovan down to the close defense. So, he was willing to make changes, and he kind of was forced to. It forced his hand when you win one of your first five games. Anyways, I digress. Rosie, when you're going up against super teams, do you have to rely on, like, a sick culture like that, or do you have to maybe not blow things up and overhaul the roster, but, like, you gotta get, like, you gotta make it an even playing field somehow, I feel.
Yeah, absolutely. You need a little bit of both, right? Vibes will only take you so far, but the happiest group of guys can still go out and get their tails whooped by some superstars, right? I don't care how good your locker room is, if you go out on the field and you just go up against a bunch of monsters, that's going to be a wrap for you. I think that was a great point you brought up about Brian Holman. I think he's another one of those coaches who understands, and eventually you gotta kind of embrace it that you gotta make some tough calls, even if you like somebody or you think You see something special in them. Sometimes you gotta just bench them or get rid of them because, ultimately it's the name of the game. You gotta just win games. You gotta get to the championship, and you gotta just put out the best team you can possibly imagine putting out. The question I think it's gonna be one for him is, are the answers going to be available from like a draft perspective? Or is he going to have to, either find some free agents or do a little poaching come player movement time? What's going to be the missing pieces that do get him over these juggernauts in the East, like you mentioned? If you got a full strength Atlas team, and then these Water Dogs, if they're all coming back and feeling healthy, and that's going to be tough to climb. I'm not sure. Just getting some more practice with the guys you have is going to be enough to do that. It's a tough battle, but I do think Coach Holman is probably more equipped to handle it now than he have ever has been in his coaching career leading up to it. I think, he's mentioned that sort of thing in the past where he's like, maybe sort of been loyal to a fault or, supportive to a guy because it's his guy, but ultimately, that could be to the detriment of the entire team if you just really believe in somebody, so you want to keep rolling them out there instead of finding a more productive option.
Yeah,
So,
especially last year. Like Ashron Olting was the best example of that to start the year, so.
it's you got to be a bad guy sometimes in that GM role, and I think that's something that is a lot more natural for some than others. But something that everybody understands, and I think he's understood it. So yeah, I'm very interested to see where they move exactly moving forward, as far as kind of shaking up the talent a little bit. But I do think they feel good about, I'd say, a super young core that they do have going through that offense in particular right now.
I've got a few more takeaways, Rosie, that you can read on insidethecross.com paired with this podcast. It was a fun weekend in Salt Lake City and just really appreciative of the ability to get out there for those games. And the altitude didn't affect me too much. I feel like I hydrated well, must have anyway, and good vibes over there, good people. And before we get into the off-season outlooks that we just alluded to, just man, I am so pumped for this title game matchup. Like the firepower of that Tvåretime quartet, of course, Jarrett Bernhardt, Pat Cavanaugh, Brennan O'Neill, to kind of a lesser degree, Logan Wisnauskas. He doesn't really have that like appeal, but like so integral to this offense in a Jake Taylor OG way. And then you got Michael Sowers and CJ Kirst, and we spent most of the podcast talking about their surrounding cast. So, Kieran McArdle, that you're always sure to make sure you're properly rating him, and Ethan Rawl, of course. But now we're going into a title game where, and Bill Tierney was funny post game where he's like, "Uh-oh, now we got to face Jake Taylor and Ben Randall over here," and just gave them to these guys that I made a little better to face us. So that's going to be good to get rid of those guys. You got to play Josh Yago and Brennan Staub, right? So it's a funny trade-off. They're getting younger. It's a young man's game. Rosie, just give me some words. How pumped are you for this matchup here?
It's funny. It's one of those things. It's like the snowball rolling down the hill, right? Like, kind of pumped in theory. And I know it's a while away, but then I start thinking about it, or you start mentioning some names, and then it's like, oh crap, let's go! I'm so fired up now. A freaking revenge game on both sides of the ball there, both sides of the offense and defense, I should say. Jake Taylor is gonna have something in store with some kind of nonsense on the crease that he's going to put in there, or at least try. And then, man, who is we talked about him already, but what are we going to see from Gavin Adler covering somebody down there? I mean, whoever it's going to be, is a matchup I would pay money just to watch, right? Like, does he end up matching up with Bernhardt at some point? Is that, I don't know. I cannot wait to find out what kind of wrinkles they have in store this time out. You know, you're going to have to make some switches, some adjustments that we haven't seen. You can't roll out the exact same thing again. Man, it's going to be nuts. There's a lot of firepower all over that field, both teams. And then if you really start digging in, kind of peeling from the X's and O's, you get into the whole storyline side of things, right? You got these outlaws who have come so close. You know, for some people, like O'Neill and Kavanaugh came so close last year. And then you have some people like your Mike Manley or your Tim Sudan himself has been there so many times and not quite gotten it done. And then you have the other side where you've got somebody like Tierney. It's like, is he going to break through and grab himself a coaching ring at the pro ranks as well? I mean, CJ Kirst, after having just won an indoor title, is he going to come back out and win an outdoor title? Could he be the best in both in the same year? I mean, it's just, there's a lot. We could just, the entire podcast could just be a run-on sentence where I talk for like a half an hour and just say, oh man. And then I just keep adding stuff. And then you could just do a half an hour saying, oh yeah, and this too. There's a lot. There's a lot going on in this game. I can't wait to just dig into it and see what's going to happen. It's going to be nuts.
A lot of semicolons separating these thoughts here. Get there early, tailgate, and get in your seats because by the way they started the semifinals, the action is going to get started really quick with O'Neill and Kirst leading the way. And when you got Sowers and Kavanaugh with their championship experience, like you said, like man, you're getting me pumped. The matchup. I feel like I could have made it a little more of a bit the title game collision course, like, and probably will continue to say it, but two very different paths, so that's super compelling as well. And to just see, you know. Yes, Sudan and Manly have been there four times, five times for Manly. O'Neill, like, there's just so much pressure on him to win one because he didn't get it done. Did not get it done in college. Of course, has the World Lacrosse Championship MVP to his name and that great game against Canada in San Diego as a Duke rising senior. Then, of course, you mentioned it last year. It's the same site where they were there against definitely the home team, right? And New York Atlas ends up winning a thriller in front of a very Atlas-friendly crowd. I think they relish being the villains of this league, you know, Kavanaugh and O'Neill and that outlaw group of, all right, we're going to come to Salt Lake City and shut you up early. How about that? What up? We're going to set the tone, whether you like it or not. And then you're going to come to Harrison, New Jersey, where we're minutes away from Philadelphia, if not maybe over an hour. I think it's within an hour. That is what
Close
I'm going
enough.
to tell myself. And at least for this agenda that I am spewing, because I think it is going to be a very friendly Water Dogs home environment, basically. I think the Water Dogs are going to have a lot more fans there than the Outlaws. Now, I did see a surprising amount of Kavanaugh jerseys in the Salt Lake City stands, but it was mostly Schreiber jerseys. Everyone was excited for his return. A lot of Connor Fields, which was cool to see, of course. Yeah, gonna be cool from a crowd perspective this game. So we'll have plenty more to preview over the next week or so for all you PLL fans listening. Rosie, we'll preview more at the end of the podcast, but let's quickly hit to the first two teams that were eliminated this season and look ahead to they have to look forward to, or not, maybe this off season. As you know, the New York Islanders finished dead last, 3-9 season. Chaos were 4-6, 4-8, 5-7, 5-7.
Think so.
They were 5-7 this year, and you know they narrowly miss out. Maybe not so narrowly, because everyone else was 6-6 in the West or 7-5. So -20 score differential, of course, was not too pretty. New York Atlas was -42. Like I said, we published the Atlas look ahead today. What were the major themes, and what are we looking forward to this offseason with the 2025 PLL champs?
Well, two birds, one stone. Major theme kind of uniting both of these bottom place finishers. A spectacular list of injuries that just kind of wrecked both teams' momentum or any sort of joy they could have had, or, maybe sniffing a postseason spot. I mean, the Atlas started off the season, right? Like, that was kind of their, basically, I want to say they were kind of defined by what wasn't going to be out there. Right, to start the whole season. Coaching staff gone. We already talked about Gavin Adler. He's gone. You lose Jeff Teat and Michael Grace before the season even gets started to injuries picked up during the NLL season. Like, that's a lot to overcome right out the gate, right? And then all sorts of injuries during the year. People being either hurt, you had some guys who got hurt during the season. And then you had some guys, like your Danny Logans or Trevor Baptistes, who were hurt during the NLL season and then showed up and weren't 100%. Maybe spent a little pup list time, maybe got out there and tried, but they're running around at 70%, 60%, maybe something like that. Somebody like Trevor Baptiste, when you're watching the games, you could tell he wasn't 100%. Like, there was never a point in time where he suited up where he looked like he looked, in a previous season or something. There was always something. You saw him with the bulky leg brace. He's trying to pop up after, winning a draw towards himself. There's not quite the pop there. We knew he was laboring through the whole year, and that was just a constant theme throughout that entire locker room. So many of those people were hurt enough to miss time, or else, hurt enough that it affected their play, but they still wanted to try gutting it out. And to very limited success. Chaos are kind of different. It seemed towards the tail portion of their season, somebody just started dropping out every game, and significant contributors, like when they lost Justin Inácio, and then all of a sudden you're like, well, what are we going to do? We'll just send out some D middies and hope for the best, right? And that's often not an effective strategy when it comes to just fundamentally winning versus losing faceoffs. It's a very thin pool to try to replace them. Didn't have much luck there. We saw Jack Rowlett, Henry Bard. Then, similar situations, guys getting hurt, maybe sticking around, maybe not. So, both of the teams, the first thing that comes to mind is just a lot of that. So, if you're looking for, a glass half full kind of thing, it's look, not only are you going to get those guys back, but law of averages, you're probably not going to experience that degree of roster wipeout next year, right? Like, if the Atlas get most of their players back to 100%, but I think after this amount of time that's going to pass, it's a fairly reasonable assumption that these guys are going to get back. Some of them are getting worked on in the off season, and some of it just takes rest for some of their guys. But either way, you would have to assume that they'll be a lot closer to old Atlas than this past year's Atlas. Granted, missing a huge part with Adler gone, but if somebody like Michael Grace is healthy and back down there as well, you have to assume he's going to help on the defensive end as well. So yeah, if you're looking for just glass half full for either of these teams, it's that element of the roster alone is most likely going to be better next year.
We're looking at close to full glasses of water as I got my glass of water here. It's about a quarter fulfilled, and we're doing a lot of talking, close to an hour recording here. Atlas is probably a little more closer to three quarters full. Chaos is closer to this cup right here. Closer to quarter full, if not a quarter empty, on the Chaos train. They just need help offensively. Like, to my overall point earlier, when you got a Philadelphia Water Dogs team that drafts that much f offensive firepower to pair with CJ and Sours, like, it is an arms race to get a lot more offensive help than when you just put out there, because that was hard to watch at times this season. Of course, we talk about the assisted goals and whatnot, but just a lot of work to do in that department. And it's a off season that I think we'll see some interesting player movement and transactions, because I think these teams, they got to be desperate to catch up, and the gap is a little too wide right now with these top two teams, where they're just too loaded to compete with, roster wise. And you can have the best culture, best coaching job you can with the Cannons and Archers this year, and you're still going to come up short. So, any other thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the chaos go, it's going to be interesting to see. They do have sort of an interesting, I guess, time crunch, right? You look at the offense, super young offense, guys. The first, we'll say, third of their season was still kind of figuring out who was going to play and who was going to play where, right? You're looking at, Brendan Nicktern in the lineup. Ultimately, he's not on the team after a while. You bring in pieces like your Teddy Malones into it, and kind of figuring out what you're going to do with your Ross Scotts, and
And that's not
stuff
going
you move
anywhere. With
in.
the overlap is going to continue.
So I think they will have at least the advantage of understanding right away, like, okay, here's what Teddy Malone can do. We'll have him day one in that position, right? I think they'll have a much better sense of identity. But I mean, you ain't lying. They gotta score more points. Assists gotta go up as well, you'd think. Kind of that really stuck out as one of their things, just not getting a lot of assisted goals. Maybe stretch the field a little bit more, maybe have some sort of distance shooting. See if they can find someone who can kind of help out in all of those elements like that, which I think will be kind of the rising tide, helps out somebody like Owen Hiltz be a little more productive next season, kind of like his rookie year. Time crunch wise, what I'm saying though is the super young offense versus the defense, where those guys have been around together forever at this point, right? So you wonder how many more years is that defense going to stay intact, or how many more years, due to something like, retirement, or, wanting to just move on, or at a certain point is Spencer Forest, Theron Brooks going to say, we can probably make this better. Right? If they feel a need to shake up the defense a little bit, I think they do have faith in the entire core, but it's almost unusual to have an entire core of a position be together for that long, other than, maybe one or two pieces going in and out, like you see with the Whip Snakes, close defense or something like that. But even still, they have, they've had goalie changes and, a couple, LSM switches out and some things like that. So we'll see if they can get their kind of perfect alignment done before the older half is no longer around, and see if the younger guys catch up, or if some of these younger guys are going to be, put by the wayside for some better options that they find along the way.
You always got a chance when Blaze Reardon is in net. Not that they're wasting a title window for that defense, but yeah, you got to figure it out offensively. Rosie, can you give us a taste, teaser, or exiters, or the semifinalist eliminations as well? Whip Snakes and the Redwoods would be next up on the docket. The two W's, two of the three W's in the league.
Yeah, both of those guys are going to be extremely busy, loaded lists of players up on expiring deals. You look at the Atlas, not too much dramatics as far as the Atlas go. Granting guys on expired deals, they locked them all up in 27-28. That was a huge emphasis on the Atlas in particular. We're not letting guys get to player movement. We're not going to mess around with that. But yeah, Redwoods have a huge list of very pivotal contributors from both Dillons, Josh Barkasel, Aiden Nenezza, all sorts of guys who put up numbers this season. They got some decisions to make there. And Redwoods have quite a not the Redwoods, Whiffsnakes have quite a few as well. Obviously, starting with Rob Pinnell, and the list goes on and on from there. So yeah, the expiring deals thing I say pops up even more with the teams that were last to check out this year, semifinals guys, and those still playing. A lot of 2026 exits there.
No doubt. And it's really fascinating. I think both are gonna stay flexible so they can splash some cash. Yeah, this is Joe Spallina's third offseason as the general manager of the Redwoods coming up, right? And both offseasons, he's reportedly sent big offers to, first it was Jared Bernhardt, who's burned him for less money with the Denver Outlaws. Then it was Brian Costabile after Gavin Adler. So he's going after both Pressler's guys and, didn't get him, re-signs all those guys. He does a great job of being able to maintain roster flexibility and has this kind of pool of guys who are hungry enough that they want to come back, but they're, and this is not talking to Joe Spallina, by the way. This is kind of my reading off a guy like Dan Arestor's reporting and your reporting of kind of intentions when you read in between the lines here of like, all right, I need to make sure I can at least send a very attractive answer or attractive offer for big names to come to this team and join the likes of Chris Kavanaugh and company, that you have a better shot in the postseason. Not because they really like their roster this year, so it'll be interesting if they go that route again, where in. Or if they kind of just sign everyone right away and don't even let them go to free agency. Whereas, the Whipsnakes are only similar insofar as Rob Pinnell and like the Scott Ratliff and Kyle Hartzell podcast hit this last week of like, you can't really run that attack line back where and we kind of touched on it too. Like, you need more dynamism with a Dodger, like Aiden Carroll moving down there. So what are we going to see with that? And Matt Brandau's health will be interesting to follow. Is this the end for Rob Pinnell? So, a lot of moving parts there and areas that they simply have to improve in to stand a chance in September. So, cannons and archers, any thoughts before we preview what we got on the docket for Champ Weekend?
We'll have to see. The archers have really kind of been quietly compiling a lot of expiring deals. I feel like they've almost been sort of a sneaky under the radar kind of deals that have run out. But they got a whole bunch of guys that they have to either figure out what they're doing moving forward, or get signing back. Guys like Connor Fields and Mac O'Keefe are both up. And then you've got some other names that they kind of need to figure out if they're going to be involved or not. I think that has a big question for them moving forward, maybe more so than other teams, like somebody like a Warren Jeffrey. Just kind of figure out what everybody's plans are. And I'll tell you this, I certainly don't know as of yet, and I'll try to find something out, but I feel very good that I'm never going to know, because Chris Bates loves not telling folks stuff. But hopefully it'll give us some sort of insight, and if not, we'll all find out together. But yeah, I mean, who knows? There could be big changes heading Utah's way as well. We'll see.
lot of like crazy possibilities on the horizon for Utah. One that Brett Dobson alluded to post game, the return of Will Schaller, who was on a absolute defensive player of the year campaign caliber senior season at Maryland. He goes down against Virginia and McCabe Millen, who probably won't be in this draft class, but has the potential to be so. Will Schaller is very fitting for this Archers defense. Be eating a lot of ice cream under Tony Resch, I have a feeling. And just the righties of, Matt Moore. I need to find out what's going on with that hip because he's so good for the PLL style play. And Grant Amant, it'll be interesting to see if he can make a return as well. So a lot of stuff going on with just guys that are like, oh, like yeah, they're archers and they can immediately make impacts there. So and I already gave you my Cannon's takes with philosophically speaking.
Yeah, we'll see. There's a lot of 2026 deals have expired. Looking forward to, finding out what this off season holds for some of these guys. This is also an exciting time to be a pro lacrosse fan. We'll see how many people come back, how many people are inspired by others to kind of test the waters. And it never a dull moment in these pro leagues these days.
Lot on the horizon, Rosie. We got plenty of stuff we're working on for next week. We already mentioned the off-season outlooks that we hit on the later stage of this podcast. We'll have another Championship Day Media Day podcast. Stay tuned for that format and release in the lead up to the title game itself. That will be on the media day is on Friday, so hopefully we get to ask some fun questions a lot of the NFL Super Bowl media day set up as well. So hopefully we can get some funny videos and whatnot out of there. End of the year award ceremony is that night on Friday night, right there in New York City. Street lacrosse the next day will be always fun to follow on the PLL socials. Then the championship, the street lacrosse on Saturday, the championship on Sunday, September 20th. 12:30 p.m. is game time. Man, Sports Illustrated Stadium was a rocking environment last year, and I expect no less, even in week two of NFL. Like, come on, guys. You got plenty of more NFL season to watch after this. I know you got all the hope for your respective teams in the world here that this is going to be year. It's not. It's time for the PLL Championship, guys. You gotta make it out to Harrison. It's gonna be a sick game. I can't wait, Rosie. We're gonna have great coverage. If you like what you heard, share with a friend. Sorry, I got fired up and might have screamed in your AirPods there. Leave a review, unless you got a headache just from that. And we'll catch you next time with more PLL Happy Hour podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.